You are listening to a free podcast of The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. To support the show and receive nearly an hour extra material daily, become a member today at majority.fm. Resistance is futile.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. It's time to look in the mirror, America. Do you like what you see?
I keep referring to Obama as the magic Negro.
Do you like what you see now?
Well, suck on this.
It's just a mirror, America.
Shared sacrifice by everybody.
What could it do to you except reflect your image?
I did nothing wrong at the Minneapolis airport.
The Majority Report.
Far more credible to me than PBS
and Frontline.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
Ever get the feeling you've been cheated?
It is Tuesday, January 22nd, 2013. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. Today on the program, Dr. Tracy Weitz, director of the Advancing New Standards in Reproductive Health program at the Bixby Center for Reproductive Health at UC San Francisco on the 40th anniversary of Roe v. Wade and the status of women's right to choose what to do with their own bodies. Also on the program today, the second term of the Obama presidency delivers, I think, rhetorically speaking, a good speech. We will get into that shortly. Republicans, they release a half a hostage, three quarters of a hostage in their debt ceiling hostage taking. Meanwhile, in sports, Phil Mickelson turns out to be a huge a-hole. Republicans still incredibly crazy. And a very convenient countdown of how many acts of gun violence or accidental shootings that took place during Gun Appreciation Day this weekend. And a couple of examples of what President Obama laid out in terms of the purpose of government action as opposed to privatization. All that and more in today's program. We are back live today. We will be getting to Dr. Weitz shortly in the program. I want to go through the speech. Let me say this right up front. That I understand the limitations of a speech. It's simply a speech. But there is relevance to an inaugural speech. And when a president is looking towards his legacy, presidents are extremely conscious of major addresses because this is the way that history records their administration. I mean, we all know that Ronald Reagan, the saint, Ronaldus Maximus Reaganus, or whatever the right loves to refer to him, raised taxes repeatedly during his administration. He grew the budget deficit. Government grew under his watch. However, his rhetoric, his speeches, shaped the conservative movement for the 25 years later. And when President Obama came to office, my expectations for him were rather low, considering what he was going to be facing in terms of the financial crisis and the existence of Republicans, frankly, and their nature. And I think it's been quite clear on those things in which I've been disappointed by President Obama over the years. And this is a speech I would have liked to see him give 4 years ago, frankly. But even if nothing happens over the course of the next 4 years, and in many instances, I'm going to probably hope that nothing does in certain situations, it is important at least that, in my mind, that the promise of a rhetorical argument for liberalism be made. And to a certain extent, I think the president made that as well as he's made it at any time over the past 4 years. Take it for what it's worth. It is worth something. And it's even that much better if he defends those principles as we go forward. But let's go through this speech briefly. The first instance in which I appreciate what he had to say came at this. This is number one. Let's play this.
We have always understood that when times change, so must we. That fidelity to our founding principles requires new responses to new challenges. That preserving our individual freedoms ultimately requires collective action. For the American people can no more meet the demands of today's world by acting alone than American soldiers could have met the forces of fascism or communism with muskets and militias. No single person can train all the math and science teachers we'll need to equip our children for the future, or build the roads and networks and research labs that will bring new jobs and businesses to our shores. Now, more than ever, we must do these things together as one nation and one people.
This is basically President Obama refuting the notion that you can use some arcane notion of what freedom is and what liberty is, that these terms need to constantly be defined based upon what we're facing in terms of reality. There is no meaning to the word freedom or liberty, as I've argued to libertarians who call into this program, unless you define it. And here he's making a very strong argument. Preserving our individual freedoms ultimately requires collective action. You are not free if you are forced to stay in a job that you do not like or that is destroying you because you need to pay for your kids' health care. You are not free. And this is, I think, one of the best arguments that encapsulates many arguments that we make in this program. That there are things that government can do better than the private sector. That there's a reason we organize in the context of a society. And that is because there are some things that society as a whole can do better than individuals. And this is not a curtailment of your freedom, but a way of expanding it, of freeing the human spirit to pursue what it wants, of not having to worry about whether or not you're going to be eating cat food, or catfish for that matter, in your retirement, that you won't be a burden to your children. And that is a ringing endorsement for things like, frankly, single payer for all, certainly Social Security and Medicare. He goes on to address, this is where we see some measure of populism when he talks about income inequality. Let's check out this clip, number two.
My fellow Americans, we are made for this moment, and we will seize it so long as we seize it together. For we, the people, understand that our country cannot succeed when a shrinking few do very well and a growing many barely make it. We believe that America's prosperity must rest upon the broad shoulders of a rising middle class. We know that America thrives when every person can find independence and pride in their work, when the wages of honest labor liberate families from the brink of hardship. We are true to our creed when a little girl born into the bleakest poverty knows that she has the same chance to succeed as anybody else because she is an American, she is free, and she is equal, not just in the eyes of God, but also in our own.
So here we have a further definition of why we organize as a society. And he keeps referencing throughout the speech, we the people, we the people, we the people. It is not simply to set up a society where a small number of people can have success. But the purpose of forming a union of we the people is so that success can be shared broadly. That the definition of the success of us organizing as a society is not to have the best hospital in the world. It's not to have the richest person. It's not to have the greatest technology. It is so that more people can have health care, so that the widest number of people can benefit from technology, from making money. But that is a fundamental distinction from what we heard and what we continue to hear from Republicans. It's frankly not necessarily consistent with all of his policies over the past 4 years. But if we're looking towards the future, if these are words that are embraced by younger generations, if this is an understanding, this is that Americans have, as opposed to, you know, Ronald Reagan saying that government is the problem, it's standing in the way, that the idea of collectivism is a detriment to our individual liberties and a detriment to our individual successes. The opposite is true of what he's saying now. And to have a generation of young people who embrace those ideas is encouraging. Let's go to number three.
A nation that rewards the effort and determination of every single American. That is what this moment requires. That is what will give real meaning to our creed. We, the people, still believe that every citizen deserves a basic measure of security and dignity. We must make the hard choices to reduce the cost of health care and the size of our deficit. But we reject the belief that America must choose between caring for the generation that built this country and investing in the generation that will build its future. For we remember the lessons of our past, when twilight years were spent in poverty and parents of a child with a disability had nowhere to turn. We do not believe that in this country freedom is reserved for the lucky or happiness for the few. We recognize that no matter how responsibly we live our lives, any one of us at any time may face a job loss or a sudden illness, or a home swept away in a terrible storm. The commitments we make to each other through Medicare and Medicaid and Social Security, these things do not sap our initiative, they strengthen us. They do not make us a nation of takers, they free us to take the risks that make this country great.
And this is really the nub of it right here. Every citizen deserves a basic measure of security and dignity. And he says we need to reduce the cost of health care and the size of our deficit. And I have no qualms with that. We do need to reduce the cost of healthcare in this country. That doesn't mean that we need to reduce the cost of Medicare or benefits to people on Medicare or Medicaid, but we need to deal with the way that we deliver healthcare in this country. Do we need to reduce the size of our deficit? It'll happen through growth. But he goes on to say, we reject the belief that Americans must choose between caring for the generation that built this country and investing in the generation that will build its future. It does not have to be borne on the backs of those people receiving Social Security. And he goes on to say, the twilight years were spent in poverty and parents of a child with a disability had nowhere to turn. He says, we do not believe in this country freedom is reserved for the lucky or happiness for the few. This is a direct refutation of everything we heard in the Republican primary. The idea that if you made a mistake in your 30s about saving for your retirement, or if you're in your 40s and you don't have health insurance and you get hit, you got to die on the side of a road. He recognizes that it doesn't matter at the end of the day how responsibly you live your life if you have bad luck, which happens to just about everybody at one point or another. A job loss, sudden illness, a home swept away in a terrible storm. I mean, this is a direct refutation now to everything that we've seen coming out of this Republican Congress just in the past weeks. And then he basically takes it directly to Paul Ryan and this whole ideology on the right. That you're a taker if you get Medicaid or Medicare or Social Security. And that they don't sap our initiative. They do not make us these drones that walk around looking for a handout from the state. But no, it frees us. Frees us to take more chances, to pursue our happiness, if we know that there is a bottom which we cannot fall through, that we will not end up living on the streets as people did in this country, thousands of them just 20 blocks south of here at the beginning of the last century. He says they free us to take the risks that make this country great. And then he pivots from that which is should be defined as economic freedoms to the notion of equal rights. And he was late to the game on this in some respects, but he made the move. He goes on to say that we need to respond to climate change. He knocks again those people on the right who deny the science. I mean, he gets very aggressive here for Obama, at least. Let's go to this fourth clip. This is where he talks about genuine equal rights for people in this country.
We, the people, declare today that the most evident of truths, that all of us are created equal, is the star that guides us still. Just as it guided our forebears through Seneca Falls and Selma and Stonewall, just as it guided all those men and women, sung and unsung, who left footprints along this great mall, to hear a preacher say that we cannot walk alone, to hear a king proclaim that our individual freedom is inextricably bound to the freedom of every soul on earth. It is now our generation's task to carry on what those pioneers began. For our journey is not complete until our wives, our mothers, and daughters can earn a living equal to their efforts. Our journey is not complete until our gay brothers and sisters are treated like anyone else under the law. For if we are truly created equal, then surely the love we commit to one another must be equal as well. Our journey is not complete until no citizen is forced to wait for hours to exercise the right to vote. Our journey is not complete until we find a better way to welcome the striving, hopeful immigrants who still see America as a land of opportunity, until bright young students and engineers are enlisted in our workforce rather than expelled from our country.
I mean, Seneca Falls and Selma and Stonewall is in, it's striking. Seneca Falls, of course, is where the women's suffragette movement more or less started. Selma, the civil rights movement, and Stonewall, referring to the riots that took place in the late 60s that really began the gay equality movement. I mean, this is pretty stunning stuff. And he goes on to say that we still must pursue equality for women. We still must pursue equality for gay people. We still must treat immigrants with respect. I mean, this is good stuff. We must protect the rights to vote. I mean, these are all important things to be out there in a 20-minute speech. And this country is going to be a much better place if he pursues these policies with the same vigor. And it certainly will be a much better place if young people listening to this adopt this vision for the country. So, you know, take it for what it is. It's only a speech, but it's an important speech. And I was not anticipating a speech like this. And so I was happy to hear it. But, you know, with that said, obviously, it's just a speech. But
I mean, it is just a speech, but who's saying it and the people who are listening, I think it does make a difference.
Well, I guess we'll see. But the point is, it could have been a very different speech.
It could have been a radically different speech. And he laid down a marker, I think. In the first term, there really was this delusion that the cause of the world's problems are because we're not talking nicely to each other.
Right.
And this is a really big distinction and place to launch from. And who knows what it will lead to. But articulating a vision versus just saying, let's all sit around and, you know, put aside the 60s debates and blah, 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 is a really big difference in terms of anchoring his presidency.
Hopefully. I think so. We'll talk more about it in the better half of the program. Let's take a break. When we come back, we'll be talking to Dr. Tracy Weitz about the 40th anniversary of Roe v. Wade and where those rights for women stand today. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report. It's a pleasure to welcome to the program Dr. Tracy Weitz, the director of the Advancing New Standards in Reproductive Health program at the Bixby Center for Reproductive Health at UC San Francisco. Welcome to the program, Professor.
Thank you for having me.
So, it's the 40th anniversary of Roe v. Wade. In many respects, I think, and tell me, I mean, from a legal perspective, The I think the re-election of President Obama, I think, is the best thing that could happen for Roe v. Wade. But on the ground, there seems to me to have been a women's right to reproductive health seems as threatened as ever.
Yeah, I think that the election of Obama secures at least the Supreme Court for this moment in time. But the fight for many decades has been at the state level, which since the Casey decision in 1992 have been allowed to regulate abortion to express their disapproval of abortion, both to women and to health care providers who offer it.
And we're looking at, particularly since 2010 in many respects, sort of an unprecedented onslaught on the state level on a woman's right to choose. You wrote recently, I think it was in the Huffington Post, to suppose that states-based abortion regulations would be less prevalent if the pro-choice movement had behaved differently or if it had different leadership is naive. Rather, the fight over abortion will continue as long as it's an effective tool of the conservative economic political establishment. Tell me what you meant by that.
Well, the country has always been quite conflicted about abortion, whether it's moral, immoral, should be regulated, should be not regulated. But abortion state restrictions really have very little to do with that fight. They are an attempt to galvanize a population of voters who otherwise would vote, whose economic interests are more aligned with the party that is pro-choice. So a way to keep that conservative, particularly evangelical Christian voters, aligned with the Republican Party and aligned with very conservative economic policies that benefit the highly wealthy, they introduce new legislation at sort of on steroid rate that says, look, we care about your issues, look what we are doing, and then it keeps people aligned with that conservative movement.
I mean, in many respects, I mean, that's how this became an issue from, I mean, at least a broader political issue from the very beginning. I mean, this was the plan since the mid to late 70s.
Right. The reason that I wrote the piece in the Huffington Post was to remind us that this has a long history of political manipulation. And it isn't that suddenly in 2010 the American public woke up and said, look, we disagree with abortion, therefore we're going to elect politicians and they're going to implement an agenda. This has been a very strategic move to align moral conservatives, social conservatives, from particular demographic groups with a conservative party who actually doesn't really care about abortion. They really care about the economic policies that they're able to get through. They cloak them in social conservatism in order to keep people voting against their own economic self-interest.
And there's also, I mean, there's a huge, I mean, I guess the irony is that there's also the implications of having of a right of women to make their own determination as to whether or not over their reproductive systems is also sort of based in the economic liberation of women as well. I mean, you know, aside from it being a fig leaf for another agenda, aside from the conservatives using abortion as one of the sort of social, identification issues, like in many respects, like guns, like marriage equality. I think there's also some real economic implications for women when it comes to having reproductive rights, which also, in some ways, impact the economics that men deal with.
Yeah, the shift to an economic system where both members of the household need to work has dramatically shifted power arrangements in families, in particular or in families that had traditional patriarchal structures. So folks who are worried that when women can control both their sexuality and their fertility, that the traditional patriarchal family structure is threatened. So absolutely, folks that are concerned about sort of male authority, folks that are concerned about men's economic predomination in the marketplace are very concerned about what abortion means in terms of women's liberation. I think that argument gets less attention in the general population because it's seen as very antiquated. I think the fact that what you saw in the Romney's inability to articulate that women should make equal pay for equal work suggests that that is actually an undercurrent of the folks who are putting forward some of these anti-abortion positions, but I think it's rarely articulated in that way because women in the workforce has become so ubiquitous. I mean, it really is not an issue that we are fighting about publicly. It may be an issue that we're fighting at through abortion regulation, but it is not actually what is gets said about the reason for these restrictions.
Yeah, I mean, I think to a certain extent, that to me is an incredibly fascinating dynamic because I think it permeates all of it. I mean, I think it obviously it triggers sort of a conservative mindset of there is that in some ways reproductive rights is threatening the traditional family, traditional family values, which in their mind is that it is extremely patriarchal. It also has implications because it creates a certain pressure on wages for men that is sort of articulated through this. And I think I think this is so bound up in it because I think a lot of the misogyny we see that is sort of woven through we see state legislatures refer to women, as cattle, I guess dropping the H instead of chattel. So much of it is bound up in that it is that this is so much of a women's reproductive rights is bound up in sort of larger questions of feminism.
Yes. The reason that you saw much more attention in this election cycle to both abortion and contraception suggests that it really is about this larger issue and not just about the moral status of the fetus. Because if it was just about the moral status of the fetus, then we'd be just having a fight about abortion. But in fact, this election cycle suggests to all of us that it's about more than abortion. It's about abortion, it's about contraception, it's about women's sexuality generally, which is about a larger set of social anxieties. And I think social anxieties that are about the disruption of the family structure, but also disruptions of sort of white elite power. I think the same backlash that you saw in abortion rights was represented in the backlash against immigration rights. You saw the same kind of sort of real anger, really hardcore policies in states around both abortion and immigration, and they have to do with the sort of crisis of power of the traditional white male-dominated patriarchal family.
And so, I mean, let me get your sense of, about, I guess it was probably about maybe in 2004, we heard a lot about Democrats traditionally considered I think quite obviously the pro-reproductive rights political movement, I guess, in this country. But we saw at that time there was an attempt to sort of blur those lines a little bit. Give me your sense of where, as a movement, and how it's aligned with the Democratic Party is today relative to just like 10 years ago.
Well, it's abortion is the single best marker of which political party you belong to. So while the country has become more nuanced in its understanding of all kinds of political issues, the abortion issue is very much party allegiance. If you're against abortion, you're more likely to be a Republican. If you're for abortion rights, you're more likely to be a Democrat. So there's been a big polarization across the parties. What that has meant to the Democratic Party is that it's trying to be a big tent, and it has reduced its sort of hardcore support for abortion rights and moved in, I think we saw this with Bill Clinton, the let's make abortion safe, legal, and rare. You saw President Obama saying let's reduce the need for abortion. This idea that there was sort of a middle ground compromise where we could all agree that we disliked abortion, but we didn't want to change its legal status. What that did for abortion conversations is highly stigmatized the women who used abortion services, mm-hmm. pretty much told them that even the party that supports their legal right to abortion does not support their use of abortion. And women became silenced. They did not tell their stories. We forgot that 1 in 3 women will have an abortion in their lifetime, that every year the same number of abortions happen as cesarean sections, and yet all of us can name a number of people in our life who've had a cesarean section this year, but we can't name the women in our lives who've had abortions. So we drove abortion much into a much more stigmatized place, not just from people who were opposed to abortion, but people who were in support of legal abortion who thought that this could be the compromise that would stop the abortion wars.
And do you think that pendulum has swung back? I mean, because it seems to me that this past election, it swung back a little bit. I mean, maybe it was more because maybe this fight was fought more on contraception than abortion over the past 10 months or so, or the past year. But do you have a sense that it swung back? I mean, just because the Democrats saw that there is that. I mean, NBC came out with a poll, I guess, just this past week, saying that for the first time, I think ever, 54% of adults say that abortion should be legal, either always or most of the time. That's the biggest majority that it's been. Do you think that that pendulum has swung back at all, at least in terms of the Democratic Party?
I do believe that it has swung back, in part because it didn't work as a strategy. Reaching out, trying to find this sort of soft compromise where we all agree we dislike abortion and we're not going to talk about it, didn't stop abortion rights opponents from pushing for harder legislation, for saying more egregious things about, let's say, you know, the idea that a pregnancy that results from rape is itself a gift from God, that it strategically did not work. So I think that many people are backing away saying, no, you know, that let's actually talk about what's true, which is that lots of women have abortions, that this is part of how they control their lives, and that we as a country affirm their legal right to do this. So I do think the pendulum is swinging back. I also think that young people who are often talked about as not caring about this issue care a lot about the economic and social stratification of access to this right, and so they're really beginning to raise their voices about the unacceptability, let's say, of the Hyde Amendment, the first compromise, the 1976 compromise that said the taxpayer dollars could not be used for abortion, that the consequences of that for poor women are now being raised by a younger generation that is much more of a social justice, has much more of a social justice orientation to abortion rights, and is just much more progressive generally. So I think that the pendulum is swinging back.
That last point is really the most interesting, is also incredibly important, I think, to note, because when you see these attacks on access to abortion in the rights, it is always really felt most by poor women. And they are also, not coincidentally, the least represented in many respects. They are the one of the weakest political constituencies. And that really is the challenge, isn't it? I mean, because a wealthy woman can take time off of work, can take a day, may not be working, can drive out of state, can go to the one abortion clinic that may be in their state 4 hours away. But if you're poor, you can't do it. I mean, I just saw some really sort of shocking percentage of women, of poorer women, end up getting abortions late because of their reduced access and the cost. So that's really where this battle is going to be fought, isn't it?
Right. The battle is now fought on the economic inequalities associated with this right. I think we can say that the right is, as a constitutional matter, the right is settled. Now, whether or not the Supreme Court, you know, overturns Roe or states continue to regulate abortions, the pendulum is moving in the direction. And we know that abortion has existed in every society since the beginning of time. It exists in all countries where it is illegal. Abortion is just a universal. It happens. Women control their fertilities. The fight now is over who gets to have access to that right and how much that right is associated with economic and social stratification. I think that puts the progressives on a much better, firmer ground because it connects the abortion issue to all kinds of other social inequalities. There's inequalities around who can raise their kids with dignity, around who gets a good education for their children, around who has access to college. When the abortion right is situated in a much larger set of requests from the progressive or demands from the progressive movement, I think it's in a much firmer and stronger place socially.
Great. Dr. Tracy Wheats, Director of the Advancing New Standards in Reproductive Health at the Bixby Center for Reproductive Right at UC San Francisco. Thanks so much for joining us.
Sure. Thank you for having me.
All right, folks. I'm going to take a break, head into the better half of the program, wherein we will be talking about we've been talking about these Republican electoral schemes over the past couple of days. Just an incredibly offensive example of this coming out of Virginia, literally yesterday. Just stunning, and we'll talk about how Phil Mickelson is a moron, and I don't know. I think he's going to lose some fans over this. I don't know. I don't follow golf enough to know necessarily, but well, just a heartwarming story of just how much guns were appreciated over the weekend during the Gun Appreciation Day. Their guns got a lot of use. Folks, it is your membership which provides 97.8% of the revenue of this program, down a couple of percentage, 0.0 percentage points, because we've had some people who quit the other day. So if you can afford to become a member, certainly you can push that percentage back up. So please do. You can become a member today at majority.fm. Other ways of supporting the show, justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, chocolate. I know a lot of you are enjoying it, and you're getting a 10% discount with the coupon code MAJORITY. You can buy the Majority Report blend. Also, if you buy crap through Amazon, buy it through our link at majority.fm. Support the show. Leave us a review on iTunes. I don't know. Buy some merch. Donate your account, your Facebook account at donateyouraccount.com/majority.fm. All that and more. You want to be a part of this program? 646-257-3920. You can IM me. Oop, I neglected to turn on my IM. I'm doing so now. See you in the better half.